in Western countries where alcohol is available and commonly used, it's the most harmful drug. Now, it's important to realise it's not the most harmful drug to the user. It's pretty harmful to the user, as you yourself have experienced. But the reason it's number one in harm overall is because so many people drink. And I'd be interested in your comment on this, but I often say almost every family in Britain has been damaged by alcohol, either because someone in the family had an alcohol problem or they came into contact with someone who was drunk, a drunk driver, or got into a fight or had something stolen by someone who was drunk.
I'm Paul Scolfort, and this is Powerful. In this series, I come clean about my own sobriety and the journey it took for me to get here. In each episode, I will speak to a special guest about their addictions and how they achieve sobriety and how they maintain a happy lifestyle today. I'm really privileged today to talk to Professor David Nutt. David Nutt is an English neuropsychopharmacologist, specialising in research of drugs and the effects on the brain and the conditions such as addiction, anxiety and sleep. He is known for his controversial removal from the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs. In 2007, Nutt published a study on the harms of drug use in The Lancet, where he showed that alcohol was more harmful than heroin, which caused dozens and dozens of headlines, and eventually his dismissal. So in some of these episodes, there will be discussions of alcohol misuse, drugs, sexual abuse, suicide, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. So good morning, David. Thank you so much for being here. It's a real privilege.
Thank you. Nice to be asked.
It's great because there's lots of communities that may not know you or know of you, and they're in a different space. So we're trying to introduce everybody to you, which should lead to your books and good education for some people not in the science field. I wanted to let you know that I have partook in taking lots of drugs in my life, lots of alcohol. Fortunately, I'm 20 years sober, and I'm really curious that what effect would the drugs had on my brain? What damage would I have done? And is it possible that it can be undone, and how much can be undone? And I'm referring to alcohol and cocaine.
Okay, so that's quite a big question. In general, permanent brain damage is rare unless you do something extreme. Like, for instance, so if when you were drunk, if you happened to fall over and bash your head, which, of course, a lot of people do when they're drunk, then the trauma will induce the brain damage. Now, obviously, alcohol and alcohol withdrawal can also induce brain damage, but that tends to be determined by how long you have been drinking. So I don't know how long you were drinking before you became sober. Can you remember?
It was about 18, 19 years.
And if you were seriously poisoning yourself then, it's conceivable that that drinking itself will have caused some brain damage. Whether it heals or not is a bit unclear at present. There haven't been good studies on that. But generally, all organs, even the brain, can heal to some extent, except if they've had this major trauma. So the answer is you probably have had some deleterious effect on your brain. But the fact that you're actually now running a successful podcast and running a charity suggests that you got enough left to be functioning. So I wouldn't worry about that.
That's good news.
Cocaine is somewhat similar. I mean, cocaine doesn't lead to as much injury as alcohol because people don't necessarily get into fights. They don't fall over as much. But on the other hand, it can lead to heart attacks and strokes. And of course, if you get a stroke or a heart attack, that can damage, impair blood flow to the brain. And then you can end up with a damage from that rather than from the drug itself. I mean, there are some drugs which, particularly people who use high levels of crystal meth, injecting crystal meth has been associated with some brain damage. But that's rather exceptional.
Yeah. So, David, does alcohol crosses the blood-brain barrier? Is that right? And if so, what is damage like wet brain, for example?
One of the reasons alcohol is such a liked drug is because it gets to its target very fast. Crosses the blood-brain barrier very quickly. You know, you get the effects within 5 or 10 minutes. In fact, you do get effects before that, by the way. You know, I mean, when you are used to drinking, as you anticipate drinking, you get effects. And certainly as you taste and you get that fat feeling in the back of the throat, those taste sensors and smell sensors go straight into the brain. So alcohol is affecting the brain even before it's actually got into the brain. But then it gets into the brain, yeah, and it sits in the brain and it does a lot of things. And what's complicated and challenging about alcohol is it starts off doing good things. Because, I mean, no one starts off drinking wanting to harm themselves. Most people start off drinking wanting to relax, chill out, you know, get rid of a bit of that social anxiety, you know, make friends at a party. But the problem with alcohol is that if you keep increasing the amount in the brain, then you end up getting other effects of alcohol that people generally don't want, which is irritability, aggression, addiction, continence, and eventually, of course, you can poison yourself and so you stop breathing.
How does the alcohol on a continued basis cause addiction? Is there evidence for how it does that?
Yeah, there is some evidence. It is slightly complicated. So it's like with everything, whenever we talk about alcohol, and to some extent it's true of other drugs, but alcohol is more complicated than any other drug because most other drugs work on a specific chemical system in the brain. So cocaine, the pleasure of cocaine comes from releasing dopamine and noradrenaline, two neurotransmitters. The pleasure of heroin or other opiates comes from stimulating opiate receptors in the brain. The problem with alcohol is that alcohol does all those things. It starts off turning on a system we call the GABA system, the calming system, which is why most of us drink in the first place. But then as you push the dose up, you start to release dopamine. That gets you high, makes you a bit louder, you know, makes you life and soul of the party. But that is beginning a pathway to addiction. It also releases endorphins, which stimulate the opiate receptors. That's beginning a pathway to addiction. And then, and this is where alcohol is particularly toxic to the brain, it begins to block the main excitatory, the main on switch of the brain is a transmitter called glutamate. And the reason people get blackouts when they drink a lot of alcohol is because alcohol blocks glutamate. And if you haven't got glutamate, you can't lay down new memories. Okay, so blackouts by themselves are not necessarily problematic. They're embarrassing, but they're not problematic. But the brain hates being blacked out. The brain knows that if you've blocked glutamate, you're on the way to death. So the brain compensates, it upregulates glutamate to try to offset the effects of alcohol. That upregulation partially works, but the upregulation extends longer than the life of alcohol in the brain. So when you're coming out of a binge or out of intoxication, your blood alcohol levels fall faster than your brain resets glutamate. So you end up, and this is what a hangover is, you end up the next day in a state where there is too much glutamate. And too much glutamate leads to anxiety, it leads to sleeplessness, it leads to irritability, it leads to hypersensitivity to light and sound, all those things you get in headaches and hangovers, and it leads to toxicity because we know that too much glutamate can damage neurons and that will contribute to essentially the cognitive damage that chronic alcohol produces. So it's alcohol coming out of the brain that's the problem, not necessarily being in the brain. It's the adaptive responses to alcohol. Too much glutamate, damaging the brain.
That's fascinating. If alcohol was controlled the same way as drugs, a dose would be about half a glass of wine. Why is there no safe amount recommended drinking?
It's a good question. And that's a relatively new discovery. I mean, look, we have known since the ancient Greeks, ancient Persians, ancient Chinese, that alcohol was a double-edged sword. People love it, but it causes problems. And over those thousands of years, we have tried to maximize and enjoy the benefits, and we have minimized the harms because we didn't know what to do about the harms. It's only 10 years ago, really, in the UK, that the Home Office accepted that alcohol was a drug. In the US, I don't think they do still accept it. They actually have a very, they have a different body of government that looks after alcohol science from looking after drug science. But anyway, the point is, it is a drug. And if we then apply the same measures that we would apply to any other drug, like, you know, is it safe? Then we discover that, as you pointed out, that the recommended maximal consumption of alcohol per year would be a glass of wine. And the reason for that is that if you put it through tests of cancer provocation, then it does have positive impacts on these cancer tests. These are sort of test tube type tests. Now, all other foodstuffs and food additives meet the criterion that the recommended amount doesn't cause cancer. Whereas in Britain, and all other countries pretty much, apart from Islamic countries, we ignore that. We decided, well, okay, it might increase the risk of cancer. And we know that alcohol increases the risk of about at least 6 cancers and maybe more. In fact, it's one of the very few things we can do to reduce our risk of cancer, particularly breast cancer, is to stop drinking. But we choose not to do that. And that's just for historical precedence, because if you told people only to drink below the cancer risk, they would ignore it because people wouldn't drink at all. So what we have to do is think more carefully about what we're trying to achieve by giving people guidelines. And I think the present guidelines are actually, they're rather clever, in that we're at the current recommended maximum of 14 units a week. There is a slight risk of cancer, there's no doubt, particularly in people who've got genetic predispositions. But the risk is still very low. The majority of cancers, if people drank below that level, would not be due to the alcohol. But when you get above that, then the risk goes up and up. The risk goes in, it's non-linear, it's like a U-shaped curve.
Which is crazy, because in our society, we're obviously not only encouraged, but we're advertised alcohol. Why do you think that still is?
Well, that's because the alcohol companies are very good at getting politicians to do what they want. Can I tell you a story?
Please do, yeah. Please do.
I think it's in the drink. I want to emphasise one thing, Paul. The book is called Drink?
Yes.
it's not an instruction to drink. It's a question whether you should drink, and it helps people work out whether they should or not. So when Blair came to power, he decided we were going to put science at the heart of policy. And he convened a group of experts, including overseas experts, to meet on a regular basis to review drugs and drug policy. And to our amazement, he said, of course, alcohol's a drug. You know, you'll have a chapter on alcohol, a chapter on tobacco, a chapter on cannabis, etc. And I was part of that group. And I used to truck up to London on a 6 o'clock train every other Monday morning to go to this meeting in the Admiralty Arch and talk about drugs and drug policy. And actually, it was an excellent committee, and we wrote a fantastic report. And then when the report got published, we noted that the alcohol chapter had been removed. And we said, hang on, where's the chapter gone? They said, we talked to the alcohol industry and said, well, you know, you guys are a bit over the top. You know, the alcohol industry told us there were benefits of alcohol, and you didn't talk about those, so we got rid of the chapter without consulting us. And obviously, he was paid off. And we believe at the time deals were being done to allow alcohol advertising again in the, I think, in the Formula One space. And we think the Labour Party was getting funds for that. And so basically, since then, governments have not confronted the drinks industry. When Cameron came to power, he said, we're going to stop advertising. Nope, they didn't stop advertising. And that's really sad, because we know that advertising actually is one of the major drivers of youth alcohol consumption.
Yeah. It's sad, isn't it? There's always rumours of, Cameron and, people partying in government, basically, as well, which I think we saw over lockdown. So there.
Well, let's face it, I think, are there 5 bars in Parliament? They're subsidised. You know, there's an awful lot of drinking goes on. And I've said, one of my team went into Westminster a few years ago as a guest of one of his friends was an advisor, and he was horrified by the amount of drinking. And we wrote a paper together suggesting that as it is the case for things like doctors, like me, you know, you wouldn't want your surgeon to operate on you if they were drunk. but politicians can literally, they can vote on us going to war drunk.
And the reality of that is, it's not really palpable, is it?
I think it's outrageous.
Yeah.
And most other governments don't work like that. There's this famous occasion, apparently, when Pitt the Younger was going to give a speech and he was so drunk he threw up behind the speaker's chair because people... And, you know, we laugh about it. And that's the problem. We laugh about it because it's all... Alcohol has been so... It's stewed, it's leached into British society so deeply. It is very hard to suck it out.
Yeah. It's pretty, part of the fabric of people's nature. And before I came into sobriety, I too would have thought things like that were funny. And then through my experience, I really see the bigger picture on the other side, you know, thank God. David, you were famously thrown out of government for saying that alcohol is more dangerous than other drugs like ecstasy. How true is that?
Well, it's utterly still true. It's true not for the UK. The technology we use is a very sophisticated technology called multi-criteria decision analysis. The results were published in The Lancet. They stirred up a lot of interest. The European Department of Justice used the same technology to assess drugs in Europe, came to the same conclusion. Alcohol is the most harmful drug in Europe. Been replicated in Australia, replicated in New Zealand. In Western countries where alcohol is available and commonly used, it's the most harmful drug. Now, it's important to realise it's not the most harmful drug to the user. It's pretty harmful to the user, as you yourself have experienced. But the reason it's number one in harm overall is because so many people drink. And I'd be interested in your comment on this, but I often say almost every family in Britain has been damaged by alcohol, either because someone in the family had an alcohol problem or they came into contact with someone who was drunk, a drunk driver, or got into a fight or had something stolen by someone who was drunk.
I think, there's stats out there that support that, but I think being in this space for 20 years, and I've done prison talks, I did a prison talk in Aylesbury Prison for the young offenders, and I would say around 75% that are there because of drunk driving. They've killed someone drinking or they've had a fight, something due to alcohol based more than any other drug at that time talking. And in my own family, we have had that experience as well with effects of drugs and alcohol. And it definitely affects people in different ways. Whether they turn into an alcoholic, they go the other way, or self-esteem issues and communication issues. And it's like a ripple effect of dropping a stone negatively.
When we looked at that scale of harm, that very famous graph now, we looked at all the different harms that drugs can do. And there are actually 16 different harms. There are nine harms to the user and seven harms to society. But one of the ones that's most important in the harms to society is the harms to families. Alcohol is so destructive to families because it's not just that it damages the person, but the person, as they're being damaged, is damaging the family through drunkenness, through fights, through rebelliousness, through stealing money, etc.
I think the biggest thing that still is peace of mind of family members.
I'm absolutely sure you're right. The knowledge that any day, you know, your son, your daughter could go out and be drunk and being harmed. You know, my mother used to stay up all night waiting for me to come back. We worry. And I say this to everyone. People say, well, alcohol, no, I drink, you know, I'm all right. You know, how can alcohol be the most harmful? You know, I'm worried about my kids taking cannabis or something. And I say, the truth is, your kids are much more likely to be harmed by alcohol than by cannabis or ecstasy or mushrooms or probably cocaine, to be honest.
I totally agree. It's a really good way of explaining. So how did you become interested in researching psychoactive drugs like LSD?
I've always been interested in drugs because as a doctor, when I started training in medicine, I've always been interested in the brain. And I was taught at university by a guy, Professor Jimmy Mitchell. And he was at the he was one of the people working out that the brain, which we used to think of as was an electrical organ, it used to be, when I was at school, and that was a long time ago, that was in the 50s and early 60s, we used to think the brain was like a connection box in a telephone exchange. Lots of wires. And we thought it was all electrical, as, you know, and now, you know, something like, you know, a chip in a computer is all electrical. But in the late 60s, early 70s, Mitchell and others began to work out that actually the connection between the different nerves in the brain was not soldered on. It's not electrical connection. It's a chemical connection. Nerves, all nerves pretty much release chemicals, which then move across a little gap called the synapse to activate receptors on other nerves. So the brain is a chemical organ. And these little neurotransmitters are very like drugs. In fact, they are so like drugs that most of the drugs we use to treat brain disorders, neurology or psychiatry, are modeled on neurotransmitters. And I was completely fascinated by that because as a doctor, as a psychiatrist, I am prescribing drugs deliberately because they mimic the chemical effects of the brain. And then during my thesis, when I was in my thesis, I began to get interested in particularly the system that controls brain activity, calms the brain. And I became quite knowledgeable and made some important discoveries about how you keep the brain under control. And that research led me to understand some of the effects of alcohol, like the effects of alcohol through the GABA system. And then I was asked to start working for the government on various drugs, MDMA to start with, and then other drugs. Never asked to work on alcohol, though. It was when I took it on myself, I got sacked.
What happened in the US in the 60s that slowed down the progress of these treatment methods?
Yes. I mean, look, it's important to realise that almost all drug policies in the history, modern history, going back to the 1850s, 60s, the banning of drugs, the prohibition of drugs has been driven. We talk about virtuous circles, but this is an unvirtuous circle. I don't quite know what the right word is. But drugs have been vilified because by Puritans. I mean, yeah, and then the temperance movement would like in the 1880s, 1890s, wanted to get rid of all drugs. And it succeeded. It succeeded in the 1920s to get alcohol banned in America. And that then had a powerful repercussion, which was that when it was unbanned, there was a huge army of people trying to destroy alcohol who were going to be unemployed. And they're now called the Feds, the Drug Enforcement Agency. And that army was re-employed to tackle other drugs, and they focused on cannabis. So they started making cannabis the dangerous drug, whereas alcohol had been the problem before. So you've got the business of prohibition, the morality of prohibition, and you've also got aspects of the pharmaceutical industry. The pharmaceutical industry wanted to patent drugs, and it wanted to stop people using plant drugs. And in fact, some of the best-selling drugs today are derivatives of plants. So it's like aspirin, you know, are derivatives of products made in plants that have been patented because the companies have made a small chemical modification. So you've got commercial interests, moral interests, and then political interests, because as you pointed out, the big problem came in the 60s with Nixon. Nixon trying to get elected, doing very badly because he was pro the Vietnam War. Most Americans didn't want a war in Vietnam. And he decided to change the narrative from let's fight in Vietnam to let's fight on the home, let's fight drugs, let's fight, you know, drugs is the number one problem in America, he said. He changed the narrative, focused on drugs, created hysteria, the war on drugs started, and he got elected. And he's gone. He was kicked out, impeached. But it's carried on because it serves a lot of a political narrative. Attacking people for using drugs is a, kind of almost a guaranteed way of getting votes because drug users don't vote, and people who vote, you know, don't like drug users.
We all have bad days, and sometimes bad weeks, and maybe even bad years. But the good news is we don't have to figure out life all alone. I'm comedian Chris Duffy, host of TED's How to Be a Better Human podcast. And our show is about the little ways that you can improve your life, actual practical tips that you can put into place that will make your day-to-day better. Whether it is setting boundaries at work or rethinking how you clean your house, each episode has conversations with experts who share tips on how to navigate life's ups and downs. Find How to Be a Better Human wherever you're listening to this.
I lived in America for some time. I actually lived in a house in Hollywood Hills behind Chateau Marmont that had a speakeasy underneath, and it was still original.
No, I suspect a lot of the listeners won't understand the origins of this. Can I just talk about that?
Please do.
Politicians are continuing, to this day, they say we've got to ban things. You know, the last Home Secretary before Cleverly, Braverman, we've got to ban nitrous oxide because it's dangerous. We've got to ban. And you say to them, well, but why? Prohibition doesn't work. Oh, yes, of course it works. He said, well, what about American alcohol prohibition? So let me tell you about alcohol prohibition. The reason there are the feds, the DEA, the reason that was set up was because alcohol prohibition led to, it didn't stop people wanting to drink, it just made it harder for them to get alcohol. So they had to get illegal alcohol. And these underground bars, speakeasies, were set up kind of almost on every street corner. If you've seen The Wire, you know, you've got the corner shop with the dealing of the heroin. In those days, it was just underground bars. Every policeman, every local cop in America was corrupted by prohibition. They were all bought off because that's the only way the speakeasies could stay open. And that's why they had to create a separate army, the untouchables, who couldn't be bought off, to fight the war against alcohol.
Which can't be a bigger shining example of what happens.
Exactly. I mean, and we know it fails. And this, don't get me started on it, but the idea that we're going to actually prosecute kids for using nitrous oxide under the misuse of drugs is beyond absurd. But anyway, let's stick to the main theme. The war on drugs is a political war. And the thing to say about it was it, because America in the 60s was so powerful, it controlled the United Nations, it became adopted into United Nations policy, where it still is. And it may never change because there are countries now which are, you know, have are much worse than America in terms of prohibition. Russia, China, Indonesia, Malaysia, they execute drug users.
They do, and then Portugal did the absolute opposite around 17 years ago and had a good example of what can change and how it can help society.
And what's interesting about the Portuguese experiment, it was driven by economics. They were filling their prisons up with drug users and they were having a massive rise in AIDS from HIV, from intravenous drug use. And they realised that they couldn't perpetuate this model. So they said, let's do it different. Let's stop punishing people for using drugs. Let's treat them and stop them using drugs. Because punishing people who use drugs doesn't ever stop them using. Usually it means that they actually have to become even more criminal to get the drugs they need. And that Portuguese experiment, in the last 20 years, they have reduced deaths from opiates, heroin deaths, to a third of what they were before. And in the UK, And this is directly at, you know, lay this absolutely at the feet of the Tory party, Cameron. He undermined the Blair and Brown did a good thing about treatment. They really invested in addiction treatment. Cameron dismantled that. He took addiction treatment out of the NHS. And as a consequence, we have doubled each year the number of people who have died as a result of opiates. So we've done exactly the wrong thing and we've had much worse outcomes in Portugal.
Yeah, you do run to the main goal, the bigger picture. Anyone I've come across, David, that has gone through a 12-step program or whatever works for them for sobriety, they're really good. They're generally smart people, very intelligent, very emotionally intelligent, but always say that one of the reasons why they use alcohol a lot initially, and you touched on this before, was really they feel very sensitive, very aware of society, very self-conscious people, and have this emotional intelligence, so they kind of can walk in and sense people in the room, and alcohol made that disappear enough for them to feel confident. Yeah, so a lot of people that are affected by it that I've come across in my years are generally good, smart human beings.
Absolutely. But, and it's really important you say that, because most politicians don't. Even if they know that, they always want to portray them as, you know, as being selfish and greedy and hedonistic. But we know a quarter of young male alcoholics have got serious social anxiety. They are drinking so that they can socialize. And then in the end, the alcohol dominates their lives. So socialization doesn't work. So it's a really sad state of affairs.
I remember reading through the grapevine about Bill Wilson, who founded AA, that he took belladonna in the 30s. That helped him have a spiritual experience. And that takes me on to Jung, Carl Jung. But he had a spiritual experience. And I believe that helped him write the big book of AA. For someone like myself, would psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy help me 20 years after putting drugs down? Because I can still have flat spots and be a bit self-conscious, whether that's just human traits or it's a causation.
Yeah, well, it's always a bit of both. So, yeah, so just to be clear, I'll embellish the Bill Wilson story a bit more, because it's not a story that is well-known, but it's a hugely influential. It's influenced me. And so Wilson was a really talented guy. He was a very intelligent young man, went to Yale, became notorious for his drinking. He'd have binges where he'd be unconscious. And when he was 33, they were talking about locking him up, putting him into a hospital for inebriates, chronic alcoholics. And they gave him an experimental treatment, which is called the belladonna treatment. And he had a profound psychedelic experience. And in some places, particularly in South America, they still use belladonna-type plants to produce psychedelic experiences. And that showed him he could escape. And he escaped from his alcoholism. He set up AA. And the driving force there was twofold. The first was being part of a community. And the second was getting people to understand there are bigger things than alcohol. You know, to try to get people who were focusing on alcohol to see that there was more than that. They can have a spiritual awakening and a higher being, they called it. In 1953, in what must have been one of the most remarkable evenings in the history of any pharmacology, Wilson sat down with Aldous Huxley, who'd previously used mescaline, to take LSD. And as a result of that experience, Wilson said, hey, wow, LSD could do in a controlled and more reliable way what belladonna did to me before. That was an accident. And he encouraged, because Alcoholics Anonymous was such a powerful organization and he was such an important person, he persuaded the US government to fund. They funded six trials of a single dose of LSD in people who were trying to stay abstinent from alcohol. And the effects were enormous. Way better than anything we've achieved since. But of course, all that has been denied to people because of the war on drugs. You know, we've got 55 years of banning a drug which could actually be the most powerful and best treatment for alcohol dependence we've ever had. But to get back to your specific question, would it help you? The answer is it probably would, but I can't encourage people to break the law. Our experience is that it helps people who are struggling with coming, you know, or reorganizing, getting their thoughts into place about the past and the future. You know, psychedelics can be powerful. Studies so far have shown that they can help people stay abstinent. We suspect they will promote abstinence as well, but those studies haven't really been done yet.
What's your hope on the future of mental health treatment, and why is it needed so much at this time?
Well, we have a mental health emergency. We have it for social reasons, you know, the uncertainty in the world, disappointments. We've been through a major financial crash in the 2008. We've been through COVID with both the psychological distress that COVID has produced because of the being locked up and uncertainty where you're going to get ill. And also a lot of people have got COVID, and COVID messes with your brain as well. So, you know, it's a sort of perfect storm of problems relating to mental health. And we know that traditional treatments are not that great. I mean, they're not bad, but, you know, they certainly need for improvement. But on top of that, many people don't realize this, but almost all the treatments we have in psychiatry and mental health, they were discovered by accident decades ago. And they've we've sort of tailored the medicines a bit to reduce side effects and improve safety, but we haven't actually come up with a conceptually new way of helping people until the psychedelics. And that's why I'm so interested in psychedelics as a therapy, because we now know from brain imaging work, they work in a fundamentally different way to traditional medicines. And that means if people haven't responded or can't respond to traditional medicines, this is another opportunity, another hope. So I suspect they're going to be a major component of mental health treatment over the next 50 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's really admirable what you're doing. And I hope that people wake up, particularly in governments, at one point.
Well, there's an opportunity now. There's an opportunity. Let's hope they seize it.
So tell us about your mission with Drug Science, David.
So Drug Science is a charity that I set up. I was the government's chief drugs advisor on a committee called the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs. And I was sacked for saying what you mentioned earlier. I was sacked for saying that alcohol was a drug and it was the most harmful drug. And focusing on drugs like MDMA was actually distracting. It was almost a ploy to stop people knowing the truth about how harmful alcohol was. Government sacked me. And amazingly, a couple of days later, a philanthropist emailed me and said, if I gave you the same money as the ACMD had, would you set up a parallel committee to tell the truth about drugs? And so I did. And we've been doing that ever since. We don't have his funding, so if any of you are out there, rich venture capitalists listening to this, want to support Drug Science, please get in touch. But we've managed to keep going now for what? Wow, it's 15 years. And we have become the sort of prime source of evidence-based education about drugs in the world. We have a global influence now, and people trust us. The media trust us. Parents trust us. And most importantly, drug users trust us because they don't trust government sites.
Yeah, and I think, to be honest, personally not being in science or government at all, I can say, not for a better sentence, word on the street is there's a lot more interest for what you're doing. So hopefully there will be someone that comes along.
Yeah, I think so. I think one of the interesting things, Paul, is that by having this discourse, you know, like we're having now and you know, many, many other areas, that didn't happen before. You know, my sacking was a kind of turning point because it actually, people said, well, hang on a sec, why have they sacked him? Oh, he said that? Well, hang on, that's obvious. Why would you sack him for telling the truth?
Common sense isn't common.
Well, yeah, but, and they, well, hang on a second, yeah. And then other scientists said, well, he said it. We all knew it. It was the elephant, it was the emperor's new clothes, wasn't it? Everyone knew that the drug policy was dishonest and not evidence-based and that alcohol was a drug, but everyone was denying it. And okay, so I was a sort of scapegoat for that. Now there is a discussion and now you've got, you know, people quite actively talking about, you know, going to Peru or Brazil and having ayahuasca experiences to heal or to...
There's lots of people. There's the people that fly in shamans as well to do ceremonies in London as well. So it's definitely filtering in.
It is, and I think that's all for the good, although, you know, I just emphasise, you know, that it's still illegal. People will still get arrested for using these drugs. So, you know, please be careful when you think about what you're doing. If people come to me and say, how can I get experiences, say, with psilocybin, we would always point them to the Netherlands, where it is legal.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, and no, I totally agree with that. What's your message, David, to young people who are considering their first drink or their first drug?
Read my book. Look, there are really some really key messages to young people about drugs.
Well, there's a trilogy now, isn't there, that you have?
That's right. There's Drink? There's Cannabis Seen Through the Smoke, and there's a new one called Psychedelics. There are some key messages to young people, right? The first is think before you do anything, right? And if you see your friends doing things and you're not sure that they're doing it, being sensible, don't just go along with them, right? That's the first thing. The second thing is never drug when you're drunk. If you're taking alcohol, don't take other drugs for two reasons. The first is that some drugs interact with alcohol. So people die because they've taken, for instance, benzodiazepines or opiates when they're very drunk. Don't do that. because of the combinations, but don't do it also because your judgment's gone. And you don't even know what you're thinking. There are examples of kids who've died when they were really drunk. They thought they were taking methadrone and they were given methadone and that killed them. So if you're using drugs, it was generally best never to mix drugs. So if you're going to use alcohol, just use alcohol. If you're going to use illegal drugs, another important message is, you know, they are illegal. Don't mess around. If you get caught, you know, then that criminal record can actually be really more destructive to your career. So be very sensible and cautious about it. And if you're going to take drugs like psychedelics, it alter your mind in a powerful way. Never, ever do it alone and never do it in a group if there's not someone else who's not doing it. And then never, ever do it in places where you're vulnerable. Like, you know, Nick Cave's kid, he went and took it off, took LSD at Beachy Head. I mean, that is the most absurd and stupid thing to do. And we don't know why he failed. Did he think he could walk? Did he want to kill himself? We don't know. But the truth is, don't ever put yourself in, don't take powerful drugs in a position where you might be vulnerable if you change, you know, if your behavior becomes a bit irrational.
Yeah, that's really smart to say. A lot of people don't think before they start embarking on drinking and drugging. There's a lot of non-alcoholic drinks now, which is great, and alternatives on the market, David. Can you tell us a bit more about Sentia, how it works and why you created it?
Yeah, I'd be very pleased to. So Sentia is a herbal cocktail.
Sorry, Sentia, that's my dyslexia. Sentia.
It's a herbal cocktail which we designed to mimic the effects of a glass of wine or half a pint of beer. It's designed to target the GABA system in the brain to give you that relaxation, that sociability that most people want alcohol for. But it doesn't go on to affect the other transmitters I mentioned already that lead you down the path of aggression or addiction or hangover. So it's my attempt to provide people with an alternative to alcohol that is less harmful, that gives most people what they want from alcohol. And I hope in the long term, you know, people will begin to migrate from alcohol to Sentia and related drinks for health reasons. Up till now, it's not been possible. Up till now, it's either alcohol or lemonade, effectively.
Yeah, so there is a complete difference from, say, someone like myself going to a bar or pub and having a non-alcoholic drink to Sentia.
Yeah, so Sentia, it's a sort of third way. We call them functional drinks because they're designed to have that pro-social conviviality effects that alcohol does. But there's no alcohol in it. And you cannot poison yourself with it. You know, it doesn't matter how much you drink. We don't recommend you drinking more than you should, but, you won't get more drunk. You won't get so blind drunk that you become ill, etc. So this is a sort of rational approach to giving most people who want to drink in a safe way. And it's very difficult, as we've said already, to do that with alcohol. But with Sentia, you can.
We're getting near to the time, David. So is there anything else that you wished that people knew generally and anything that would change our relationship with drugs and drink?
Just to re-emphasise, the drug laws are politically driven. Politicians will tend to say, well, and a lot of people will agree with them, well, does it really matter if, you know, we criminalise a few reprobates, you know, because they're using drugs? You know, there's no harm in it. You know, okay, so we fill our prisons and waste money, but, you know, they deserve it somehow. You know, punishing the other is why we've been allowed to get away with the drug laws. But what they overlook is they're punishing themselves because they are denying access of powerful medicines to millions of people. I've estimated that in the 55 years since LSD has been made illegal, over 100 million people worldwide will have died prematurely from alcohol dependence. Now, if LSD helped 10% of them get sober, probably more, but let's say it was just 10%, that's 10 million lives saved. How many lives have been saved by banning it? Well, probably none. But, you know, you could say make up a number of 1,000, even 1,000,000. The equation is so loaded in favour of it being a therapy. And that hidden damage of the drug laws hasn't been made explicit, and we should do it. And that's what we're doing now, trying to make MDMA a medicine and psilocybin a medicine. We're trying to break that terrible stranglehold on therapy that the drug laws have produced. My wife is telling me I've got to talk about the Hippocratic Oath. She's coming, and Yeah. She's a fan of mine, which is surprising, I suppose, having lived with me all these years. So I often have this slide in my talks when I talk about the Hippocratic Oath for doctors. There's not one for lawyers, which is wrong. You know, the first driver of the law should be first, do no harm.
Yeah, I totally agree. It should be as well. David, I feel really privileged. Thank you so much. And this is going to help a lot of people and a new audience as well. I'm very grateful for that. And what we'll do, we'll put your books on the notes on our website and on our charity website as good pointers, if you don't mind.
Yes, please. I'd love you to do that.
Great. Thank you very much.
This podcast is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also make a donation. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. And if you enjoyed This Is Powerful, please rate, review, and follow the podcast to share it with your friends, your family, anyone you can, and head over to social media. I always love to see and hear how you react to the episodes, and it's so helpful for our content to be shared. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica and Marty, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Henry, you know who you are, and to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. And there's a whole catalogue of episodes wherever you get your podcasts. But did you know you can also watch it on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with Paul Scholfer.
Hi, I'm Pandora Morris, and if you're someone who's ever felt overwhelmed by life's mental challenges, I think you'll really relate to my podcast, Hurt to Healing. I've spent over 20 years struggling with my own mental health, but what I found is that every story, every challenge has something to teach us. On my podcast, I speak with incredible people who open up about their own struggles, whether it's OCD, grief, addiction, or anything else that life throws at us. It's raw, it's honest, and it's all about helping you feel a little less alone. So, if you're looking for real conversations that inspire hope and healing, come and join me. Subscribe now to Hurt to Healing, and let's discover the lessons we can take from every story.